her that there had been others. I didn't want to tell her why I hadn't gone to all the murder scenes. If Z hadn't wanted to talk about my trip Underhill with me, I thought it would not be something he wanted me discussing with a lawyer. She paused again. There were 4 people murdered in the reservation, and they did not ask for help. I gave her a thin smile. The Fae are not fond of attracting outside attention. It can be dangerous for everyone. They are also quite aware of the way most humans, including the Feds, feel about them. The only good Fae is a dead Fae mentality is quite prevalent among the conservatives who make up most of the rank and file in the government, whether they be Homeland Security, FBI, BFA, or any of the other alphabet soup agencies.
You have trouble with the federal government? She asked.
As far as I know, none of them are prejudiced against half-Indian mechanics, I told her, matching her blandness with my own. So why would I have a problem with them? However, I can certainly see why the Fae would be reluctant to turn over a series of murders to a government whose record for dealing with the Fae is not exactly spotless. I shrugged. Maybe if they'd realized sooner that their killer wasn't another Fae, they might have done so. I don't know.
She looked down at her notes. So you told Z that O'Donnell was the killer?
I nodded. Then I took Z's truck and drove home. It was early in the morning, maybe 4 o'clock, when we parted company. It was my understanding that he was going to go over to O'Donnell's and talk to him.
Just talk.
I shrugged, glanced at Kyle, and tried to decide how far I trusted his judgment.
All the truth, hmm?
I sighed. That's what he said, but I was pretty sure that if O'Donnell didn't have a good story, he wouldn't wake up this morning. Her pencil hit the table with a snap.
You are telling me that Z went to O'Donnell's house to murder him?
I took a deep breath.
You aren't going to understand this. You don't know the Fae, not really.
Imprisoning a Fae is impractical. First of all, it's damn difficult. Holding a person is hard enough. Holding a Fae for any time at all, if he doesn't want to be held, is near impossible. Even without that, a life sentence is highly impractical, when Fae can live for hundreds of years.
Or a lot more, but the public didn't know that.
And when you let them go, they aren't likely to shrug it off as justice served. The Fae are a vengeance-hungry race. If you imprison a Fae for whatever reason, you'd better be dead when he gets out, or you'll wish you were. Human justice just isn't equipped to deal with the Fae, so they take care of it. A Fae who commits a serious crime, like murder, is simply executed on the spot. The werewolves did the same. She pinched the bridge of her nose as if I were giving her a headache.
O'Donnell wasn't Fae. He was human.
I thought about trying to explain why a people who were used to dealing out their own justice would care less that the perpetrator was human, but decided it was pointless. The fact remains that Z did not kill O'Donnell. Someone got there first. Her bland face didn't indicate belief, so I asked, "Do you know the story of Thomas the Rhymer?"
"True, Thomas. It's a fairy tale," she said, "a prototype of Irving's Rip Van Winkle."
I said, "actually, I'm under the impression that it was mostly a true story. Thomas's, I mean." Thomas was, at any rate, a real historical person, a noted political entity of the 13th century. He claimed that he'd been caught for 7 years by the Queen of the Fairies, then allowed to return. He either asked the Fairy Queen for a sign that he could show his skin so they would believe him when he told them where he'd been, or he stole a kiss from the Fairy Queen. Whatever the reason, he was given a gift, and like most fairy gifts, it was more curse than blessing. The Fairy Queen rendered him incapable of lying. For a diplomat or a lover or a businessman, that was a cruel thing to do. But the Fae are often cruel.
Your point?
She didn't sound happy. I guess she didn't like thinking any of the fairy tales were true. It was a common attitude. People could believe in the Fae, but fairy tales were fairy tales. Only children would really believe in them. It was an attitude that the Fae themselves promoted. In most folk tales, the Fae are not exactly friendly. Take Hansel and Gretel, for instance.
Z once told me that there are a lot of fae in the Rez, if left to their preferred diets, would happily eat people, especially children.
He was cursed to become like the fae themselves, I told her. Most fae, including Z, cannot tell a lie. They are very, very good at making you think they are saying one thing when they mean another, but they cannot lie.
Everyone can lie.
I smiled at her tightly. The fae cannot.
I don't know why. They can do the damnedest things with the truth, but they cannot lie. So, I sighed unhappily. I had tried to figure out a way to leave Uncle Mike out, but unfortunately, there was no other way to tell this part.
Z and I hadn't talked since his arrest. That was a matter of public record. I had to convince her that Z was innocent.
I haven't spoken to Z yet, so I don't know what his story...
No one has, she said. My contact at the police department assured me that he hasn't spoken to anyone since he was arrested. A wise move that allowed me to talk to you before I speak to him.
There was another fae who went with Z. He's the one who told me Z didn't kill O'Donnell. He and Z walked in and found the dead body about the same time the police showed up. The other fae was able to hide himself from the police, but Z did not.
Could he have hidden too?
I shrugged. All the fae have glamour, which allows them to change their appearance. Some of them can hide themselves entirely. You'll have to ask him, though he probably won't tell you.
I think Z did it so that the police wouldn't look too hard and find his friend.
Self-sacrifice.
Maybe someone who hadn't been raised with werewolves wouldn't have seen the scorn she felt for my theory. Fae, she apparently thought, weren't capable of self-sacrifice.
Z is one of the rare Fae who can tolerate metal. His friend is not. Jail would be very painful for most Fae.
She tapped the end of her notebook on the table.
So the point of all this is that you say a Fae who cannot lie told you Z didn't kill O'Donnell. That won't convince a jury.
I was hoping to convince you.
She raised her eyebrows. It doesn't matter what I think, Ms. Thompson.
I don't know what expression was on my face, but she laughed.
A lawyer has to defend the innocent or the guilty, Ms. Thompson. That's how our justice system works.
He isn't guilty,
she shrugged. Or so you say. Even if Z's friend can't lie, you aren't Faye, are you? At any rate, no one is guilty until convicted in a court of law. If that's all you have to tell me, I'll go talk to Mr. Adalbert Smiter.
Can you get me into O'Donnell's house? I asked. Maybe I can find out something about the real murderer.
I tapped my nose.
She considered it, then shook her head.
You've hired me to be Mr. Adalbert Smiter's attorney, but I feel some obligation to you as well. It would not be in your best interest, nor in Mr. Adalbert Smiter's best interest, to prove yourself something other than human at the moment. You are paying for my services, so the police will look at you. I trust they won't find anything.
Nothing of interest.
No one knows that you can change.
No one who would tell the police.
She picked up her notebook and set it down again. If you have been reading the papers or following the national news, you'll know that there are some legal issues being brought up about the werewolves.
Legal issues. I suppose that was one way to put it.
The Fae, by accepting the reservation system, had opened up the path for a bill to be introduced in Congress to deny the werewolves full citizenship and all the constitutional rights that came with it. Ironically, it was being proposed as an amendment to the Endangered Species Act.
Ms. Ryan nodded sharply.
If it comes out that you can become a coyote, the court might find your testimony inadmissible, which might have further legal consequences for you.
Because they might decide I was an animal and not human, I thought.
Anything you find would be flimsy evidence, even if it was admitted. The court is not going to have the same view on your reliability as Z apparently did. Especially as you will have to declare yourself a separate species, which might be a very dangerous thing for you to do at this time.
The werewolf bill wouldn't pass. Bran had too much influence in Congress. But I was neither werewolf nor fae, and the same protection might not cover me.
She frowned and moved her notebook restlessly.
You should know that I belong to the John Lawrence Society.
I looked at Kyle. The John Lawrence Society was the largest of the anti-fae groups. Though they maintained a front of respectability, there had been allegations last year that they had funded a small group of college-age kids who had tried to blow up a well-known fae bar in Los Angeles. Luckily, their competence hadn't matched their conviction, and they'd only managed to do a little minor damage and send a couple of tourists to the hospital for smoke inhalation. The authorities had caught them rather quickly and found an apartment full of expensive explosives. The kids had been convicted, but the authorities hadn't managed to build a case against the larger, wealthier organization. I had access to information not available to the authorities, and I knew that the John Lawrence Society was a good deal dirtier than even the FBI suspected. Kyle had found me a lawyer who not only disliked Faye, she'd like to see them eliminated. Kyle patted my hand.
Jean won't allow her personal beliefs to interfere with her job.
Then he smiled at me.
And it will make a point having someone so active in the anti-Fae community defending your friend.
I'm not doing it because I believe he is innocent, she said. Kyle turned his smile to her, and it became shark-like. He seldom showed anyone that side of him.
And you can tell the newspapers and the jury and the judge that, and it still won't stop them from believing that he must be innocent or you wouldn't have taken the case.
She looked appalled, but she didn't disagree. I tried to imagine working a job where your convictions were an inconvenience that you learned to ignore, and decided I'd rather turn a wrench, no matter how much better her paycheck was than mine.
I'll stay away from the crime scene then, I lied.
I wasn't a fae. What the police and Ms. Ryan didn't know wouldn't hurt them. The coyote is a sly beastie, and no stranger to stealth, and I wasn't about to let Z's fate depend wholly on this woman. I'd find out who killed O'Donnell, and figure out a way to prove him guilty that didn't involve me telling 12 of my peers that I smelled him. I picked up a couple of buck burgers and fries from a fast food place and drove home. The trailer was looking as spiffy as a 70s single-wide could. New siding had made the porch look tacky, so I'd repainted it gray. Samuel had suggested flower boxes to dress it up, but I don't like living things to suffer unnecessarily, and I have a black thumb. Samuel's Mercedes was gone from its usual spot, so he must still be at Tumbleweed. He'd offered to come with me to meet with the lawyer. So had Adam, which is how I ended up with just Kyle, whom neither of the werewolves looked upon as a rival. I opened the front door, and the smell of crockpot stew made my stomach rumble its approval. There was a note next to the crockpot on the kitchen counter. Samuel had learned to write before typewriters and computers rendered penmanship an art practiced by elementary school children. His notes always looked like formal wedding invitations. Hard to believe a doctor actually wrote like that. Mercy, his note said, with lovely flourishes that made the alphabet look like artwork. Sorry I am not here. I promise to volunteer at the festival until after tonight's concert. Eat something. I followed his advice and got out a bowl. I was hungry. Samuel was a good cook, and it was still a few hours until dark. O'Donnell's address was in the phone book. He lived in Kennewick, just off Olympia, in a modest-sized house with a neat yard in the front and an 8-foot white fence that enclosed the backyard. It was one of the cinder block houses that were fairly common in the area. Recently, someone had been of the mistaken impression that painting it blue and putting shutters on the windows would make it look less industrial. I drove past it, taking in the yellow police line tape that covered the doors and the darkened houses to either side of it. It took me a while to find a good parking spot. In a neighborhood like this, people would notice a strange car parked in front of their house. Finally, I parked in a lot by a church that was not too far away. I put on the collar with the tags that gave Adam's phone number and address as my home. One trip to the dog pound had left me grateful for this little precaution. I didn't look anything at all like a dog, but at least in town there wouldn't be angry farmers ready to shoot me before they saw my collar. Finding a place to change was a little more challenging. The dog pound I could deal with, but I didn't want to get a ticket for indecent exposure.
Finally, I found an empty house with a realtor sign out front and an unlocked gardening shed. From there, I only had to trot a couple blocks to O'Donnell's house. Happily, O'Donnell's backyard fence ensured his backyard was private because I had to change back and get out the picks I taped to the inside of the collar. It was still close enough to summer that the night air was pleasant. A good thing, since I had to pick the damn lock stark naked, and it took me too long. Samuel had taught me to pick locks when I was 14. I hadn't done it a lot since then. Just a couple of times when I'd locked my keys in my car. As soon as I had the door open, I replaced the picks inside my collar. Bless duct tape, it was still sticky enough to hold them. A washer and dryer were just inside, with a dirty towel laid across the dryer. I picked it up and wiped the door, doorknob, lock, and anything else that might have picked up my fingerprints. I didn't know if they had something to check for bare footprints, but I wiped the floor where I had taken a step inside to reach the towel, then tossed it back on the dryer. I left the door mostly shut, but unlatched, then shifted back into Coyote, hunching under the gaze of eyes that weren't there. I knew, that no one had seen me go inside. The gentle, gusty wind would have brought the scent of anyone skulking about. Even so, I could feel someone watching me, almost as if the house was aware of me. Creepy. With my tail tucked uncomfortably close, I turned my attention to the task at hand, the sooner to leave. But unlike the Fay houses, this one had seen a lot of people in and out recently. Police, I thought. Forensic team. But even before they had come, there had been a lot of people in the back hallway. I hadn't expected an obnoxious boor like O'Donnell to have a lot of friends. I ducked through the first doorway and into the kitchen, and the heavy traffic of people mostly faded away. Three or four light scents. O'Donnell and someone who wore a particularly bad male cologne had been in here. The cupboard doors gaped, and their drawers hung open and a little askew. Dish towels were scattered in hasty piles on the counter. Maybe Cologne Man was a police officer who searched the kitchen. Unless O'Donnell was a sort who randomly shoved all of his dishes to one side of a cupboard and stored his cleaning supplies in a pile on the floor, instead of tucked neatly in the space under the sink behind the doors that hung open, revealing the empty, dark space beneath. The faint light of the half-moon revealed a fine black powder all over the cupboard doors and countertops that I recognized as a substance the police used to reveal fingerprints. The TV is a good educational tool, and Samuel is addicted to those forensic soap opera mystery shows. I glanced at the floor, but there was nothing on it. Maybe I'd been a little paranoid when I'd wiped the place where I'd stood on the linoleum with bare human feet. The first bedroom, across the hall from the kitchen, was obviously O'Donnell's. Everyone from the kitchen had been in here, including Cologne Man. Again, it looked like someone had gone through every cranny. It was a mess. Every drawer had been upended on the bed, then the whole dresser had been overturned. All of his pants pockets had been turned inside out. I wondered if the police would have left it that way. I backed out of there and went into the next room. This was a smaller bedroom, and there was no bed. Instead, there were three card tables that had been flung helter-skelter. The bedroom window was shattered and covered with police tape. Someone had been angry when they'd come in here, and I was betting it wasn't the police. Avoiding the glass on the floor as much as I could, I got a closer look at the window frame. It had been one of those newer vinyl ones, and the bottom half had been designed to slide up. Whatever had been thrown through the window had pulled most of the framing out of the wall as well. But I'd known the killer was strong. He had, after all, ripped off a man's head. I left the window to explore the rest of the room more closely. Despite the apparent mess, there wasn't much to look at. Three card tables and 11 folding chairs. I glanced at the window and thought that a folding chair thrown very hard might break through a window like that. A metal machine that looked oddly familiar had left a dent in the wall before landing on the ground. I pawed it over and realized it was an old-fashioned mail meter. Someone had been sending out bulk mail from here. I put my nose down and started to pay attention to what it had been trying to tell me. First, this room was more public than the kitchen or first bedroom, more like the back door and hallway had been. Most houses have a base scent.
mostly a combination of preferred cleaning supplies, or lack thereof, and the body scents of the family who live in it. This room smelled different from the rest of the house. There had been, I looked again at the scattering of chairs, maybe as many as 10 or 12 people who came to this room often enough to leave more than a surface scent. This was good, I thought. Given the way O'Donnell had rubbed me wrong, anyone who knew him was likely to have murdered him. However, I took another look at the window. There hadn't been a fae or any other magical critter in the bunch that I could tell. No human had taken out the window that way, or torn off O'Donnell's head either. I memorized their scents anyway. I'd done what I could with this room, which left me with only one more. I'd left the living room for last for two reasons. First, if someone were to see me, it would be where the big picture window looked out onto the street in front of the house. Second, even a human's nose could have told them that the living room was where O'Donnell had been killed, and I was growing tired of blood and gore. I think it was dread of what I'd find in the living room that made me look back into the bedroom, rather than any instinct that I might have missed something. A coyote, at least this coyote, stands just under 2 feet at the shoulder. I think that's why I never thought to look up at the pictures on the wall. I thought they were only posters. They were the right size and shape, with matching cheap plexiglass and black plastic frames. The room was dark, too, darker than the kitchen, because the moon was on the other side of the house. But from the doorway, I got a good look at the framed pictures. They were indeed posters, very interesting posters for a security guard who worked for the BFA. The first showed a child dressed in a fluffy Easter Sunday dress sitting on a marble bench in a garden-like setting. Her hair was pale and curly. She was looking at the flower in her hand. Her face was round with a button nose and rosebud lips. Bold letters across the top of the poster said, "Protect the Children." Across the bottom, in smaller letters, the poster announced that Citizens for a Bright Future was holding a meeting the November 18th of 2 years ago. Like the John Lawrence Society, Bright Future was an anti-fae group. It was a lot smaller organization than the JLS and catered to a different income bracket. Members of the JLS tended to be like Ms. Ryan, the relatively wealthy and educated. The JLS held banquets and golf tournaments to raise money. Bright Future held rallies that mostly resembled the old-fashioned tent revival meetings where the faithful would be entertained and preached at, then passed a hat. The other posters were similar to the first, though the dates were different. Three of them were for meetings held in the Tri-Cities, but one was in Spokane. They were slick and professionally laid out. Stock posters, I thought, printed at the headquarters without dates and places, which could be added later in Sharpie black. They must have been meeting here and sending out their mailings. That's why there had been so many people in O'Donnell's house. Thoughtfully, I padded into the living room. I think I'd seen so much blood the night before that it wasn't the first thing that struck me, though it was splattered around with impressive abandon. The first thing I noticed was that under the blood and death, I caught a familiar scent that was out of place in this room. Something smelled like the forest fae's home. The second thing I noticed was that whatever it was, it packed a tremendous magical punch. Finding it, though, was more problematical. It was like playing find the thimble with my nose and the strength of the magic to tell me if I was hot or cold. Finally, I stopped in front of a sturdy gray walking stick tucked into the corner behind the front door, next to another taller and intricately carved stick, which smelled of nothing more interesting than polyurethane. When I first looked at the stick, it appeared unremarkable and plain, though clearly old. Then I realized that the metal cap wasn't stainless steel. It was silver, and very faintly I could see that something was etched into the metal. But it was dark in the room, and even my night eyes have limits. It might as well have had a clue painted in fluorescent orange down the side. I thought long and hard about taking it, but decided it was unlikely to go anyplace, having survived O'Donnell's murderer and the police. It smelled of wood smoke and pipe tobacco. O'Donnell had stolen it from the Forest Fae's home. I left it alone and began quartering the living room. Built-in bookshelves lined the room, mostly full of DVDs and VHS tapes.
One whole bookshelf was devoted to the kind of men's magazines that people read for the articles and argue about art versus pornography. The magazines on the bottom shelf had given up any pretense of art, judging by the photos on the covers. Another bookcase had doors that closed over the bottom half. The open shelves at the top were mostly empty, except for a few chunks of rocks. I recognized a good-sized chunk of amethyst and a particularly fine quartz crystal. O'Donnell collected rocks. There was an open case for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang sitting on top of the DVD player under the TV. How could someone like O'Donnell be a Dick Van Dyke fan? I wondered if he'd had a chance to finish watching it before he died. I think it was because I felt that moment of sorrow that I heard the creak of a board giving way beneath the weight of the house's dead occupant. Other people, people who are completely mundanely human, see ghosts too. Maybe not as often or in broad daylight, but they do see them. Since there had been no ghosts at the death sites in the reservation, I'd unconsciously assumed that there would be none here as well. I'd been wrong. O'Donnell's shade walked into the living room from the hallway. As some ghosts do, he grew clearer in bits and pieces as I focused on him. I could see the stitching on his jeans, but his face was a faded blur. I whined, but he walked by me without a glance. There are a very few ghosts who can interact with the living, as much a person as they had been in life. I got caught once talking to a ghost without realizing that's what he was until my mother asked me whom I was talking to. Other ghosts repeat the habits of a lifetime. Sometimes they react, too, though I usually can't talk to them. There is a place near where I was raised where the ghost of a rancher goes out every morning to throw hay to cows who are half a century gone. Sometimes he saw me and waved or nodded his head, as he would have responded to anyone who'd approached him in life. But if I tried to converse with him, he'd just go about his business as if I weren't there at all. The third kind are the ones born in moments of trauma. They relive their deaths until they fade away. Some dissipate in a few days, and others are still dying each day, even centuries later. O'Donnell didn't see me standing in front of him, so he wasn't the first, most useful kind of ghost. All I could do was watch as he walked to the shelves that held the rocks and touched something on the top shelf. It clicked against the fake wood shelf. He stood there for a moment, his fingers petting whatever he touched, his whole body focused on that small item. For a moment I was disappointed. If he was just repeating something he'd done every day, I wouldn't learn anything from him. Then he jerked upright, responding, I thought, to a sound I could not hear, and he walked briskly to the front door. I heard the door open with his motions, but the door, more real than the apparition, stayed closed. This was not a habitual ghost. I settled in, prepared to watch O'Donnell die. He knew the person at the door. He seemed impatient with him, but after a moment of talk, he took a step back in invitation. I couldn't see the person who came in. He wasn't dead, or hear anything except the creaks and groans of the floorboards as they remembered what had happened here. Following O'Donnell's attention, I watched the path of the murderer as he walked rapidly to a place in front of the bookcase. O'Donnell's body language became increasingly hostile. I saw his chest move forcefully, and he made a cutting gesture with one hand before storming over to confront his visitor. Something grabbed him around the neck and shoulder. I could almost make out the shape of the murderer's hand against the paleness of O'Donnell's form. It looked human to me. But before I could get a good look, whoever it was proved that they were not human at all. It was so fast. One moment, O'Donnell was whole, and the next, his body was on the floor, jerking and dancing, and his head was rolling across the floor in a lopsided, spinning gyre that ended not a foot from where I stood. For the first time, I saw O'Donnell's face clearly. His eyes were becoming unfocused, but his mouth moved, forming a word he no longer had breath to say. Anger, not fear, dominated his expression, as if he hadn't had time to realize what had happened. I'm not a terrific lip reader, but I could tell what he'd tried to say. Mine.
I stayed where I was and shook for minutes after O'Donnell's specter faded. It wasn't the first death I'd witnessed. Murder is one of those things that tend to produce ghosts. I'd even cut someone's head off before, that being one of the few ways you can make sure that a vampire will stay dead. But it hadn't been as violent as this, if only because I'm not strong enough to rip someone's head off. Eventually, I remembered that I had things to do before someone realized there was a coyote running free in a crime scene. I put my nose down on the carpet to see what it could tell me. Distinguishing any scents at all here proved difficult, with O'Donnell's blood soaking into couch cushions, walls, and carpet. I caught a hint of Uncle Mike's scent in one corner of the room, but it faded quickly. And though I searched the corner for a while, I never caught it again. The cologne man had been in the living room, along with O'Donnell, Z, and Tony. I hadn't realized Tony had been one of the arresting officers. Someone had been sick, just inside the front door, but it had been wiped up and left only a trace. Other than that, it was like trying to pick up a trail in the Columbia Center Mall. There had simply been too many people in here. If I was trying to pick out a scent, I could do that. But trying to distinguish all the scents, it just wasn't going to work. Giving up, I went back to the corner where I'd scented Uncle Mike just to see if I could pick him up again, or figure out how he managed to leave only the barest trace for me to find. I don't know how long it was there before I finally looked up and saw the raven.
Chapter 5. It watched me from the hall doorway, as if it had simply found the open back door and flown in. But ravens are not night birds, despite their color and reputation. If there had been nothing else, that alone would have told me that there was something off about this bird. But that wasn't the only thing, or even the first. As soon as I caught the glitter of the moon's light and the shine of its feathers, I smelled it, as if it hadn't been there until then. Ravens smell of the carrion they eat, overlaying a musty, sharp scent they share with crows and magpies. This one smelled of rain, forest, and good black garden soil in the spring. Then there was its size. The Tri-Cities has some awfully big ravens, but nothing like this bird. It was taller than the coyote I was, easily as big as a golden eagle, and every hair on my body stood up to attention as a wave of magic swept through the room. It took a sudden hop forward, which moved its head into the faint light that trickled through the windows. There was a spot of white on its head, like a drop of snow. But what caught most of my attention were its eyes, blood red like a white rabbit's. They glittered eerily as it stared right at me, and through me as if it were blind. For the first time in my life, I was afraid to drop my eyes. Werewolves put great value on eye contact, and I'd blithely used that all my life. I have no trouble dropping my eyes, acknowledging anyone's superiority, and then doing whatever I please. Among the werewolves, once dominance was acknowledged, the dominant werewolf could, by custom, do no more than cuff me out of his way, while I then ignored him or plotted how to get back at him, as I chose. But this wasn't a werewolf, and I was consumed with the conviction that if I moved at all, it would destroy me, though it was not making any sign of aggression. I value my instincts, so I stayed motionless. It opened its mouth and gave a rattling cry, like old bones shaken roughly in a wooden box. Then it dismissed me from its notice. It strode to the corner and knocked the walking stick to the floor. The raven took the old thing into its mouth, and without so much as a glance over its shoulder, took flight through the wall. 15 minutes later, I was well on the way back home, in human shape, and driving my car. Being not exactly human myself and raised by werewolves, I'd thought I'd seen just about everything. Witches, vampires, ghosts, and a half dozen other things that aren't supposed to exist. But that bird had been real, as solid as me. I'd seen its ribs rise and fall as it breathed, and I'd touched that walking stick myself. I'd never seen one solid object go through another solid object, not without some pretty impressive CGI graphics or David Copperfield. Magic, despite Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie, just doesn't work like that. If the bird had faded, become immaterial or something before it hit the wall, I might have accepted that as magic.
Maybe, just maybe, I'd been like the rest of the world, accepting the Fae at their face value. Acting like they were something familiar, that they were constrained by rules I could understand and feel comfortable with. If anyone should have known better, it would be me. After all, I well understood that what the public knew about the werewolves was just the polished tip of a nasty iceberg. I knew that the Fae were, if anything, worse about secrecy than the wolves. Though Z had been my friend for a decade, I knew very little about the Fae side of his life. I knew he was a Steelers fan, that his human wife had died of cancer shortly before I met him, and that he liked tartar sauce on his fries. But I didn't know what he looked like beneath his glamour. There were lights on at my house when I pulled the rabbit into the driveway and parked it next to Samuel's Mercedes and a strange Ford Explorer. I'd been hoping Samuel would be home and awake so I could use him as a sounding board, but the SUV put paid to that idea. I frowned at it. It was 2 in the morning, an odd time for visitors. Most visitors. I took in a deep breath through my nose, but couldn't catch a whiff of vampire or anything else. Even the night air smelled duller than usual. Probably just a leftover from the shift from coyote to human. My human nose was better than most people's, but quite a bit less sensitive than the coyote's, so changing to human was a little like taking out a hearing aid. Still, vampires could hide their scent from me if they chose to. I shivered in the warm night air. I think I would have stayed out there all night, except that I heard the murmur of guitar. I couldn't see Samuel playing for Marsilia, the mistress of the vampire seethe, so I climbed up the steps and went in. Uncle Mike sat on the overstuffed chair Samuel had replaced my old flea market find with. Samuel was half stretched out on the couch like a mountain lion. He played idle bits of music on his guitar. He might look relaxed, but I knew him too well. The cat who was purring on the back of the couch just behind Samuel's head was the only relaxed person in the room.
"There's hot water for Coco," said Samuel without looking away from Uncle Mike. "Why don't you get yourself some? Then come tell us about Z, who put you on the scent of their murderer so they could go kill him. Then tell me what you've been doing tonight that would leave you smelling of blood and magic."
Yep, Samuel was ticked at Uncle Mike. I riffled through the cupboards until I found the box of emergency cocoa. Not the milk chocolate with marshmallow kind, but the hard stuff. Dark chocolate with a bit of jalapeno pepper for flavor. I wasn't really upset enough now to need it, but it kept me busy while I thought about how I might keep matters peaceable. Real cocoa needs milk, so I put some in a saucepan and began heating it up. I'd left Samuel and the other werewolves this morning knowing only that Z was in jail and needed a lawyer. Obviously someone had filled Samuel in a bit since then. Almost certainly not Uncle Mike. Probably not Warren, who would know everything from the lawyer's meeting. I'd told Kyle to go ahead and tell him what I'd told the lawyer. Warren could keep secrets. Ah, Warren wouldn't keep secrets from his pack Alpha, Adam. Adam would see no reason not to tell Samuel the whole story if he asked. See, that's the thing about secrets. All you have to do is tell one person, and suddenly everyone knows. Still, if I disappeared, I'd like to know that the werewolves would come looking for me. Hopefully the Fae and the person of Uncle Mike understood that, and I wasn't likely to just disappear. If the Grey Lords would arrange a suicide for Z, one of their own who was of some value, they certainly wouldn't hesitate to arrange something to happen to me as well. The pack would make that a little more difficult. A cup of liquid doesn't take long to heat. I poured it into a mug, took the first sip, bittersweet and biting, then rejoined the men. My deliberations in the kitchen led me to the couch, where I sat with a whole cushion between me and Samuel, so I wouldn't be assumed, by Samuel, to be taking a side in the antagonism that was stirring in my living room like the inky surface of Loch Ness just before the monster erupts. I didn't want any eruptions in my living room, thank you. Eruptions meant repair bills and blood. Growing up with werewolves had left me hyper-aware of power struggles and things unspoken. With another werewolf, a show of support might put the likelihood of violence down a few notches because he would feel more confident. Samuel didn't need more confidence.
He needed to know that I felt that Uncle Mike had done the right thing by calling me in, no matter what Samuel's opinion on the matter was. I found a good lawyer for Z, I told Uncle Mike.
She is a member of the John Lawrence Society.
Uncle Mike seemed much more himself than he'd sounded on the phone. That meant that his cheerful innkeeper guise was in full swing. I couldn't tell if he was unhappy with my choice of lawyers or not. Kyle, I stopped myself and backed up.
I have a friend who is among the best divorce attorneys in the state. When I called him, he suggested this Jean Ryan from Spokane. He told me she was a barracuda in the courtroom and says that her membership in a Faye hate group will actually help. People will think that she must be absolutely convinced of Z's innocence to take this case.
Is that true? She believes him innocent?
I shrugged. I don't know, but both Kyle and she say it won't matter. I did my best to convince her. I took a sip of cocoa and told them everything Ms. Ryan had told me, including her warning that I keep my nose out of police business. Samuel's lips quirked at that.
So how long did you wait before going to O'Donnell's after she told you not to?
I gave him an indignant look. I wouldn't have done it before dark. Too many people would have been calling animal control if they saw a coyote that far into town, collar or not. I can't do much investigating from the animal shelter, and they've already picked me up once this summer. I looked at Uncle Mike and wondered how to get him to tell me all the things I needed to know. Did you know that O'Donnell was involved with Citizens for a Bright Future? He sat up straighter.
I'd have thought he would be smarter than that. If the BFA had known, he'd have lost his job.
He didn't say that he'd been unaware of it, I noticed. He didn't seem too worried about anyone finding out, I told him. There were Bright Future posters all over the walls of one of his rooms.
The BFA doesn't exactly make a habit of searching their employees' houses. Their funding just got cut again, and the money's diverted to that mess in the Middle East.
He didn't sound too upset about the BFA's troubles. I rubbed my tired face. The search wasn't as much help as I'd hoped. I didn't find a scent, except for O'Donnell himself, of anyone who was in the reservation murder scenes. I don't think that there was anyone with him when he killed the Fae. Except maybe Cologne Man, I thought. I had no way of telling what he really smelled like, though I had not the slightest idea why he'd have worn cologne to kill O'Donnell and not for killing the Fae. Surely he wouldn't expect a werewolf or someone like me to be tracking down O'Donnell's killer.
So your visit was uneventful.
That was Samuel, his voice just a little more intense than the soft harp-like notes he was calling from the guitar. If he kept playing like that, I was going to be asleep before I finished.
Why, then, do you smell like blood and magic?
I didn't say it was uneventful. The blood is because the living room of O'Donnell's house was covered in it. Uncle Mike gave a faint grimace, which I didn't believe at all. My experience with immortals might be with werewolves, but the Fae aren't a kind and gentle people either. He might have been thrown off his game when Z was taken into custody, but blood and gore never really bothered the old ones. The magic, I shrugged. It could have been a number of things. I saw the murder take place.
Magic?
Uncle Mike frowned.
I didn't know you were a far-seer. I thought that magic didn't work around you.
That would be terrific, I said, but no, magic works around me for the most part. I just have some kind of partial immunity to it. Usually the way it works is that the less harmful the magic is, the better the chance it won't work. The really bad stuff usually does just fine.
She sees ghosts, said Samuel, impatient with my whining.
I see dead people, I deadpanned back. Oddly, it was Uncle Mike who laughed. I hadn't thought he'd be a moviegoer.
So did these ghosts tell you anything?
I shook my head. No, I just got the playback of the murder with O'Donnell as the only player. I think the killer was after something, though. Did O'Donnell steal from the Fae? Uncle Mike's face went blank, and I knew two things. The answer to my question was yes, and Uncle Mike had no intention of telling me what O'Donnell had taken. Just for kicks, I said, instead of waiting in vain for his answer, how many Fae are there who can take on the shape of a raven?
Here?
Uncle Mike shrugged.
5 or 6.
There was a raven in O'Donnell's house, and it reeked of Fae magic.
Uncle Mike gave an abrupt, harsh laugh.
If you're asking if I sent someone to O'Donnell's house, the answer is no. If you're wondering if one of them killed O'Donnell, the answer is still no. None of those with a raven shape have the physical strength to tear off someone's head.
Could Z? I asked. Sometimes if you ask unexpected questions, you get answers. His eyebrows rose and his brogue grew thicker.
Sure, and why would you ask that? Haven't I told you he had naught to do with it?
I shook my head. I know Z didn't kill him. The police have an expert who told them that he could. I have reasons to doubt her ability, and it might help Z if I know exactly how far off she is. Uncle Mike took a deep breath and tilted his head to the side.
The Darksmith of Trondheim might have been able to do what I saw, but that was a long time ago. Most of us have lost a bit of what was once ours over the years of cold iron and Christianity. Z, less than most, though. Maybe he could have. Maybe not.
The Darksmith of Trondheim. He'd said something like that before. Trying to figure out who Z had once been was one of my favorite hobbies, but the current situation made the small jewel of information taste like ashes. If Z lost his life over this, who he had once been was irrelevant. Just how many of the Fae in the reservation, I thought about that and reworded it a little, or in the Tri-City area could have done that?
A few, Uncle Mike said without taking time to reflect. I've been racking my head all day. One of the ogres could have, though I'll be a Catholic monk if I know why they would want to. And once they get to that point, they'd not have stopped until they'd had a bite or two. None of the ogres were particularly friendly with any of the victims on the reservation, or anyone else, except maybe Z. There are a few others who might have been capable of it once, but most of them haven't fared as well as Z in the modern world.
I remembered the power of the Sea Man. What about the man I met in the Selkies? I glanced at Samuel and bit my tongue. That ocean I knew was a secret. That ocean I knew was a secret, and it could have no impact on Z's fate. I wouldn't speak of it in front of Samuel, but that left my sentence hanging in the air.
What man?
Samuel's question was mild, though Uncle Mike's words coming right over the top of Samuel were not. I could smell Uncle Mike's fear, harsh and sudden, like his words. It wasn't an emotion I associated with him. After a quick, wary look around the room, he continued in an urgent whisper.
I don't know how you managed it, but it would do you no good to speak of the encounter. The one you met could have done it, but he has not bestirred himself this past 100 years.
He took a breath and forced himself to relax.
Trust me. It wasn't the Grey Lords who killed O'Donnell Mercedes. His murder was too clumsy to be their work. Tell me more of this Fae Raven you encountered.
I stared at him a moment. Was the Sea Fae one of the Grey Lords?
The Raven, he prompted gently.
So I told him, backing up a bit to tell him about the staff, then about the Raven leaping through the wall with it.
How did I miss the staff? Uncle Mike asked himself, looking thoroughly shaken.
It was tucked in a corner, I told him. It came from one of the victim's houses, didn't it? The one who smoked a pipe and whose back window looked out over a forest. Uncle Mike seemed to come back to himself, and he stared at me.
You know too many of our secrets, Mercedes.
Samuel set his guitar aside and put himself between us before I had time to register the menace in Uncle Mike's voice.
Careful, he said, his voice thick with wails and warning. Careful, green man. She's put her neck out to help you. Shame upon you and your house if she comes to harm bite. Two, Uncle Mike said. Two of the Grey Lords have seen your face in our business, Mercy. One might have forgotten, but two never will.
He waved an impatient hand at Samuel.
Oh, stand down, Wolf. I'll not harm your kit. I only spoke the truth. There are things not nearly so benign who will not be happy about her knowing what she knows, and two of them already have.
Two? I asked in a voice that was smaller than I'd meant it to be.
That was no raven you met, he said grimly. It was the great Carrion Crow herself.
He gave me a long look.
I wonder why she didn't kill you.
Maybe she thought I was a coyote, I said in a small voice. Uncle Mike shook his head.
She might be blind, but she perceives more clearly than I still.
There was a brief silence. I don't know what the others were thinking about, but I was contemplating just how many close calls I'd been having lately. If the vampires didn't hurry, the Fae or some other monster would kill me before she got a chance. What had happened to all the years of carefully keeping to myself and staying out of trouble? You are sure that one of the Grey Lords didn't kill O'Donnell? I asked.
Yes, he said firmly, then paused. I hope not. If so, then Z's arrest was intended, and he is doomed. And probably me as well.
He ran a hand along his chin, and something about the gesture made me wonder if he'd once worn a beard.
No, it was not they. They aren't above a messy kill, but they wouldn't have left the staff for the police to find. The Carrion Crow came to keep the staff out of human hands, though I'm surprised she didn't retrieve it sooner.
He gave me a speculative look.
Z and I weren't in that living room long, but we'd never have overlooked the staff. I wonder...
What is the staff? I asked. I could tell it was magic, but nothing else.
Not of interest to you, I trust, said Uncle Mike, coming to his feet. Not for you to fuss with when there's the Carrion Crow about. There's money in the briefcase.
For the first time, I noticed a brown leather case tucked against the arm of his chair.
If it is not enough to cover Z's expenses, let me know.
He tipped an imaginary hat toward Samuel, then took my hand, bowed, and kissed it.
Mercy, I'd be doing you no favors if I didn't tell you to stop. We appreciate the help you have given us so far, but your usefulness ends here. There are things going on that I'm not at liberty to tell you. If you continue, you are not going to discover anything. And if those nameless ones find out how much you know, it will go ill with you, and there are too many of them about.
He nodded sharply at me, then at Samuel.
I'll bid you both good morning.
And he was out the door.
Keep your weather eye on him, Mercy,
Samuel said, still standing with his back to me as we watched Uncle Mike's headlights turn on as he backed out of the driveway.
He's not Z. His loyalties are to himself and his alone.
I rubbed my shoulders and stood up myself. Never have a discussion with a werewolf when he's standing and you're sitting. It puts you at a disadvantage and makes them think they can give you orders. I trust him about as far as I can throw him, I agreed. Uncle Mike wouldn't go out of his way to harm me, but... You know, one of the things I learned growing up about you wolves was that sometimes the most interesting part of the conversation with someone who can't lie is the questions they don't answer. Samuel nodded.
I noticed it, too. That staff, whatever it is, was stolen from one of the murder victims, and he didn't want to talk about it.
I yawned twice and heard my jaw pop the second time.
I'm going to bed tonight. I have to go to church in the morning.
I hesitated. What do you know about the blacksmith of Trondheim? I was tired, and the heap of my worries was a weight I was staggering under. Z, the Grey Lords, Adam and Samuel, and the wait for Marsilia to find out that Andre had not been killed by his helpless victims. However, I'd been searching for stories about Z for years. Too many of the Fae treated him with odd respect for him not to be in stories somewhere. I just couldn't find them.
The Dark Smith, Mercy. The Dark Smith.
I tapped my toe, and Samuel gave in.
Ever since I saw his knife, I've wondered if he was the Dark Smith. That one was supposed to have forged at least one blade that would cut through anything.
Trondheim, I muttered. Trondheim? The old capital of Norway? He's German. Samuel shrugged.
Or he's pretending to be German, or the old story could have it wrong. In the stories I heard, the Dark Smith was a genius and a malicious bastard, a son of the King of Norway. The sword he made had a nasty habit of turning on the man who wielded it.
I thought about it for a moment. I guess I could believe a villain before I'd believe a story about him being a goody-goody hero.
People change over the years, said Samuel.
I looked up sharply and met his eyes. He wasn't talking about Z anymore. There were only a few feet between us, but the gulf of history was much larger. I'd loved him so much once. I'd been 16, and he'd been centuries older. I'd seen in him a gentle protector, a knight who would rescue me and build his world around me, someone for whom I would not be an obligation, a burden, or a bother. He'd seen in me a mother who could bear his living children. Werewolves, with one exception, are made, not born. It takes more than a nip or two, or, as I read in a comic book once, a scratch of a claw. A human who wants to change must be savaged so badly that he either dies or becomes a werewolf, and is saved by the rapid healing that is necessary to surviving as a hot-tempered monster among other such beasts. Women don't survive the change as well as the men, for some reason. And the women who do cannot bear children. Oh, they're fertile enough, but the monthly change at the full moon is too violent, and they abort any pregnancies when they shift from human to werewolf. Werewolves can mate with humans, and often do, but they have a terribly high miscarriage rate, and higher than usual infant mortality. Adam had a daughter born after his change, but his ex-wife had had three miscarriages while I knew her. The only children who survive are completely human. But Samuel had a brother who was born a werewolf, the only one that anyone I know had ever heard of. His mother was from a family that was gifted with magic native to this land and not Europe, as most of our magic-using humans have. She was able to hold off the change every month until Charles's birth. Weakened by her efforts, she died at his birth, but her experiences had started Samuel thinking. When I, neither human nor werewolf, was brought to his father for his pack to raise, Samuel had seen his chance. I don't have to change, and even when I do, the change is not violent. Though real wolves in the wild kill any coyotes they find in their territory, they can mate and have viable offspring. Samuel waited until I was 16 before he made me fall in love with him. "We all change," I told him. "I'm going to bed." Just as I've always known there are monsters in the world, monsters and things even more evil, I've always known that it is God who keeps evil at bay. So I make a point of going to church every Sunday and praying on a regular basis. Since killing Andre and his demon-bearing spawn, church was the only place I felt truly safe.
"You look tired."
Pastor Julio Arnez's hands were big-knuckled and battered. Like me, he'd worked with his hands for a living. He'd been a lumberman until he retired and became our pastor. "A little," I agreed.
"I heard about your friend," he said. "Would he appreciate a visit?"
Z would like my pastor. Everyone liked Pastor Julio. He might even manage to make being in jail more bearable, but getting close to Z was too dangerous. So I shook my head. "He's fey," I said apologetically. "They don't think very highly of Christianity. Thank you for offering."
"If there's anything I can do, you tell me," he said sternly.
He kissed my forehead and sent me off with his blessing. Z on my mind, as soon as I got home, I called Tony on his cell phone because I had no idea how to get in to see Z. He answered sounding cheerful and friendly rather than coolly professional, so he must have been home.
"Hey, Mercedes," he said. "It was not nice of you to sick Ms. Ryan on us. Smart, but not nice."
"Hey, Tony," I said. "I'd apologize, but Z matters to me, and he's innocent, so I got the best I could find. However, if it makes you feel any better, I have to deal with her, too." He laughed.
"All right. What's up?"
"This is stupid," I told him, "but I've never had to go visit anyone in jail before now. So how do I go about seeing Z? Are there visiting hours or what? Should I wait until Monday? And where is he being held?" There was a short silence.
"I think visiting hours are weekends and evenings only. But before you go, you might talk to your lawyer," he said cautiously.
Was there something wrong with me seeing Z?
"Call your lawyer," he said again when I asked him.
So I did. The card she'd given me had her cell on it as well as her office.
"Mr. Adalbert Smiter is not talking to anyone,"
Jean Ryan told me in a frosty voice, as if it were my fault.
"It will be difficult to mount an effective defense unless he talks to me."
I frowned. Z could be cantankerous, but he wasn't stupid. If he wasn't talking, he had a reason. I need to see him, I told her. Maybe I can persuade him to talk to you.
I don't think you're going to persuade him of anything.
There was a bare hint of smugness in her voice.
When he wouldn't respond to me, I told him what I knew about O'Donnell's death, all that you had told me.
That was the only time he spoke.
He said that you had no business telling his secrets to strangers.
She has